Welcome to this episode of On the Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. In each episode, we speak to various professionals and experts to gain insight in legal careers, law school, and other exciting developments in the law. Without further delay, sit back and enjoy today's interview. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of LSE Law Society's On the Case podcast. I'm Saima, and I will be your host for today's episode. Today, we have invited Brookline, a leading junior barrister at Landmark Chambers, to have a conversation with us about everything property law. Brooke specializes in real estate matters alongside commercial and residential landlord and tenant disputes. She has worked on numerous high-profile cases, including the 2023 Supreme Court case Aviva Investors v. Williams & Oars. And for all of our budding future barristers listening, Brooke also films her own webinars and lectures, which are all available to watch on the Landmark Chambers YouTube channel. You can purchase her co-authored 2019 book, On Your Feet, a practical guide to civil advocacy for a realistic insight into junior barristers' court work. Welcome, Brooke, and thank you so much for making the time to join us today.
You're very welcome, and thank you for that very kind introduction. What I should say is my 2019 book is only helpful if you are practicing. Don't expect it to be some really insightful fiction novel, because it will terribly disappoint you, all right?
Before we begin, could you tell us about your academic and vocational journey? Did you know it was always going to be law for you? And essentially, how did you get to the Brooke that we're listening to today?
I knew from a relatively young age that I might want to be a lawyer. My background is that no one in my family has been to university before. Both of my parents had what I'd describe as working class jobs. And both my siblings, including both my older sister and my younger brother, both left school at 16, didn't do A-levels. So certainly going off to university was not something that anybody sort of in my family had done before. I was really keen to. I really studied hard at school and really wanted to think about a career potentially in law. And I was desperate to go to Cambridge. It was the first university I visited, and it was a bit like going to Hogwarts for me, and I was a big Harry Potter fan. I did apply, and I actually applied to do an English degree, partly because I loved English. It was my favourite subject at school, but also because I thought I might not get in for law. I was a bit worried that I didn't have any, you know, I had no lawyer connections. I had quite a lot of financial help in terms of I applied for scholarships for both the GDL and for my bar course. And I was lucky enough to get those from the Inn.
I'm sure it's been like really rewarding to see how all your efforts and just everything that you've worked for basically come to fruition for you. I actually had the pleasure of meeting Brooke at a panel event organised by the Property Bar Association about 2 months ago at King's College. What struck me immediately about Brooke was how relatable she is. You said you've come from a non-traditional background. You're a first-generation university student. You come from a humble working-class family, like a lot of us. I wonder during your studies or your pupillages whether you ever felt a sense of imposter syndrome.
Even to this day, I still go into court. I still have interactions with colleagues where I suddenly think, at some point, someone's going to realise they're going to catch me out and I shouldn't be here. And I felt that at university. I felt that at all stages coming to the bar, and I still do feel it at times now.
Do you have any advice for how we can overcome these feelings?
You have to get the confidence from within. And sometimes you might have to work harder than your counterparts, particularly if it's something that you don't have familiarity with and you can't call upon people that you know or resources in the way that others potentially can. If you work hard enough and you really want it and you have the skills, hopefully the belief and the confidence will come with time.
Let's move on to the first segment of today's podcast and discuss property law more generally as a vocation for yourself. For the students who are still unsure which route to take, why did you personally choose the barrister pathway?
Towards the end of my degree, I met someone at a student law event that I'd attended. I met someone, actually a judge, and he was really kind enough to let me go and shadow him for a few days. He was a criminal judge, and he said to me at the time, you should really think about the solicitor route. Whilst I think he would be a really good candidate for the bar, the solicitor route is financially slightly more secure. And I thought long and hard about that, and I applied for some vacation schemes, and I interviewed at a couple of, sort of good firms for vacation schemes. It just wasn't the career that I wanted. I liked the idea of being self-employed. I liked the idea of being in court. And so in the end, for me, the type of life a barrister has was something I really wanted and I knew would suit me.
Why does your passion lie specifically in property law, and what draws you to this area of practice?
I have to be entirely honest with listeners. I didn't know I wanted to be a property lawyer when I started out. I was on my GDL when I applied for pupillage and got pupillage. And at that point, I'd done all of about 2 or 3 months of law. So you'll know now much more than I did then about the law. It's also black letter law, which I actually prefer to perhaps slightly more creative areas like public law. That's what drew me to it. I also knew it was an area of law where there was a decent amount of court work, and I'd been caught from a relatively early stage, which is unusual because property falls within what we describe as chancery work. And chancery work in general, you don't go to court that much, particularly when you're junior. But property, unlike general chancery work, you do actually go to court quite a bit. Can't tell you though that I knew from the outset, and I don't think those of you that are thinking about pupillage or what areas of law you might be interested in, I wouldn't worry too much about not knowing from an early stage. I mean, who knows until you start practicing whether you're going to enjoy it. And lots of people start off in one area and change over time or specialize. So yeah, I think that's what I'd say on that issue.
That actually leads us on nicely to the next question. What would you say is the best way for a law student to find their own specialty? Would you say it's possible to also specialize in a different array of fields?
Start with the last part of that question. It's certainly possible to be a sort of a barrister that's not a specialist as I am. I am a quite a specialist property practitioner. There are people at lots of sets of chambers who are more generalist practitioners. So they might do family and criminal law, or they might do family, criminal, and a little bit of civil. I think it's a case of thinking about the types of chambers to apply to that might suit a range of possibilities. If you've decided, you know, these few areas are not really for me, I've not really enjoyed studying them, or I didn't really enjoy perhaps some work experience, if you could manage it in that area, then trust your instincts on that and decide, well, actually, that was an area I wasn't interested in. These are other areas that I might find interesting. Ultimately, it is a career generally for life. So you do want to make sure you sort of try to work that out over time. But I wouldn't expect to know that, certainly as an undergraduate. And even when you're applying for pupillage, if you don't know precisely what area you're going to practice in, that's okay.
For the listeners who are sure that they do want to specialise in property more specifically, what would you say are key skills they would require to succeed in the field?
You do need to have that, you do need to be bright. The second quality, I think, is having really good attention to detail. Sometimes the answer to quite a complex legal question might fall on the meaning of a couple of very specific terms in a lease or a document. And if you don't have the attention to detail, you might not even see them. And then I think, thirdly, I think it's actually a slightly more practical skill, and that is reasonably good at being commercial and practical. It's one thing knowing the law, and obviously that's sort of a given. You do need to be able to work out what the law is and apply it to your case. But often with property work, I guess similar to commercial work, it's actually coming down to what is the commercial answer for your client? What is the practical way of getting your client either out of a problem or pursuing litigation tactically and strategically to get them the outcome they want? And having that kind of practical brain is really important because, you know, it's really important to be academic and to be able to look at the law and understand it, but also having those sort of skills to kind of turn that into advice that's going to be meaningful.
For the next question, how would you say the application of property law differs in practice from the rigid textbook format that we learn as students?
Take the average dispute over a right of way. I had a case a few weeks ago that involved a right of way. On its face, incredibly dry. When you're reading it in the textbook, incredibly dry. It's potentially quite complicated. This was a case about two neighbours that hate each other. And that's what made the case interesting. Yes, of course, there were legal arguments and there was case law I needed to refer to, some of it very old. But actually, what was interesting about it was this relationship between two people who really don't like each other and have decided to litigate this matter to a trial where they're going to leave it up to somebody they've never met before to decide something they could have potentially solved between them. And that human interest is often what makes cases and practicing law so much more interesting than just, okay, what does the textbook say? And you do get a lot more exposure in property law to arguing about law, which I find really interesting, but applying it to the human context and the specific land issues that are going on.
Before we move on to the final segment of today's episode, I wanted to pose some fire round questions. It's going to be, well, I'm hoping it'll be a little bit more fun. What is one aspect of the law that confused or challenged you as a student?
Quis clos trusts.
I think I fell asleep. like in that half of, yeah, I need to revise that again. What is one of the most memorable or rewarding cases you've worked on?
So I worked on a case pro bono a few years ago that involved a very vulnerable guy who lived on a houseboat, and his housing benefit had been stopped because basically it was a long, tortuous argument, but essentially they were saying that it wasn't property for which he was entitled to housing benefit, because essentially it wasn't a house. And we managed on appeal to successfully get him his housing benefit back. And it's not the kind of case I do generally anymore, and it was obviously pro bono, but it was one of those cases where it was a really meaningful and really good decision. So
what is the one thing you wish you knew before becoming a barrister?
How brave some of the time you need to be.
What would you say is a common misconception people have about working in property law?
We're all really dull. Actually, we're really quite an interesting bunch.
That brings us on to the last segment of today's episode. We'll now be discussing property law more in depth. So, Brooke, you were called to the bar in 2016. What do you think has become one of the most significant changes in the statute concerning property law?
Many of you will recall the Grenfell fire in 2017. To my mind, the biggest piece of legislation since then is the Building Safety Act, which has not done everything, but it has been a huge overhaul of building safety and leaseholder protections in respect to building safety. And I've done quite a lot of that work. As I say, it's still not perfect and there's a long way to go. But from my perspective, I think it's one of the biggest and perhaps the most important pieces of legislation for a generation.
Moving on to the next question, you specialise in residential as well as commercial property. How would you say cuts to legal aid funding have affected litigation or even the amount of cases you're involved in?
When I first started out, I used to do legal aid work. I took the financial decision when I moved chambers not to do it anymore, which was a personal decision, partly because financially it was difficult, but also the legal aid agency are renowned terrible when it comes to actually paying you. So when I moved chambers, I had a lot of debt, some of which is still unpaid from the legal aid agency. And lots of people take that decision, which means that there isn't enough lawyers out there to do the legal aid work that is available. And also it's so poorly paid that unfortunately lots of people take the view that actually it's not an area of practice that I can sustain. And that's terrible. And to my mind, it has massively degraded our justice system and the justice that you can get from our justice system, because in my view, it's much better to have two legally represented parties. You're much more likely to get a just outcome if you're doing it on an even footing. And unfortunately, the courts just do not now operate in that way.
I think the saddest part about the point about debt, it's pushing barristers and solicitors more away from the pro bono side. I mean, I do some volunteering admin work with the East Greenwich Legal Advice Clinic, and it's really alarming to see how the vulnerable and the elderly have to deal with really important legal paperwork on their own.
Yeah.
Just the vocabulary is really complex in itself. What would you say could be a practical solution to educate the layman about the law and involve society more with the law as a whole?
Two key things I would suggest. The first is, I think it should be a part of every person's education at school, is a basic understanding of just how our justice system works, and perhaps a brief overview of some of the key areas of law. I'm not talking about an undergraduate degree, but you know, for example, understanding what types of behaviour are a criminal offence, for example. The law assumes from the age of 10, after we all have legal responsibility and we're capable of being convicted of a criminal offence, that suddenly on the day you turn 10, you understand the entirety of the criminal law. And that just seems to me to be completely unrealistic. So I think legal education from quite a young age, actually, from perhaps the age of 10, just to ensure that people have a sense of what their legal responsibilities and potential liabilities are. And then the second thing, this is so basic, is that legislation.gov website, which is the kind of the government's website that's supposed to have up-to-date pre-available legislation, it's never updated. So you actually have to have a subscription like I have in chambers, my chambers pays for, to Westlaw, or quite a specialist subscribed access to that, enabled to check what is the most up-to-date legal position. That should not be the case. It should be available to everybody free online, and it should be updated so that whenever you check to see what the law says, it's correct.
This next question, I'm extremely intrigued in hearing it from a legal perspective. So Labour has promised or had promised to build 1.5 million new homes in the UK. Do you think that this common rush within the government's manifestos to expand homes is the biggest reason for building defects?
Firstly, I should say, I think that ambition is a really good one. We need more homes. Part of the reason why it's so difficult for people to get on the housing ladder or indeed to rent at a sensible, sensible price is because we don't have enough homes. There is demand outstrips supply. I think it is a hugely ambitious target. And those planning barristers at Landmark might be able to tell you a bit more about whether it's capable of being achieved. If it is achieved, I think that would be a good thing. But you're absolutely right to point out, well, isn't there a problem here that if we rush to build all these homes, will they actually be fit and proper? And after the Grenfell fire tragedy, that is as good a reminder as we could ever have that we need to not just build lots of homes, we need to build proper homes that people are going to live in and are going to be safe for people to live in and that will endure. I've done plenty of cases in the last 5 or 10 years in my practice about new build homes that are not fit for purpose, new build homes that are damp within a year of the person moving in. And that's a new build property. It's one thing to have a 90-year-old house that was built with no damp proof course and it be damp, but it's a totally different thing that something that was built a couple of years ago has already got that problem. So yeah, I think that's an issue and it is one that does concern me.
I think also like that just goes to show how the law shouldn't just accustom to like the legal perspective. It's like a blend of everything. Like all the disciplines should like come together and like formulate an answer that hopefully the government can give like people when they ask these really like complex questions. Moving on, based on the wealth of the Supreme Court cases you've worked on, what is one practical way property law could further redress or balance the rights of landlords and tenants in the coming years?
Oh,
Bit loaded, but.
that's tricky. I don't know so much whether it would be a Supreme Court decision. I don't think we need that. I mean, you'll be aware, I'm sure, that the Renters' Rights Act is going to come into force relatively soon. It's still a bill at the moment, but it's going to come into force relatively soon, and that's going to abolish Section 21, which means there won't be no-fault evictions. I think that will redress the balance to some extent between landlords and tenants. I think the single most important thing that could happen to balance those rights would be for the justice system to be operating properly. One of the biggest things I get as a complaint from my landlord clients is the justice system is just so slow. And they're right about that. Sometimes it might take you've got a really difficult tenant who perhaps stopped paying their rent and is perhaps causing lots of antisocial behaviour and all of the neighbours are complaining. It might take you two. Sometimes 3 years to deal with that situation. And that's not sustainable. By the same token, like I said earlier, there should be proper legal advice available to tenants to ensure that they get proper advice. And if the justice system were working properly and efficiently and effectively, so you could get justice in a sensible period of time, whether you're a landlord or whether you're a tenant, that it seems to me would be the best thing. Same goes for tenant cases. I've had tenant cases where they're trying to get their landlord to carry out works to a property that's damp or there's an issue, and it takes 2 years to do that. And in those 2 years, young children are living in a damp property that ought to not be damp. The justice system working properly, to my mind, would be the best possible way of getting redress for both landlords and tenants properly and quickly.
To what extent has home ownership become an unattainable goal for those outside the highest income brackets?
Yeah, that is definitely the case. And I do think the generations, my generation, millennial generation, but also Gen Z, I think we're sort of getting to the point where most people think, well, it's never going to happen for me anyway. To some extent, that is obviously a real problem. And our parents and our grandparents were used to thinking about home ownership as a goal. In some ways, I think the shift back is not necessarily the end of the world. And that's easy for me to say. Because I'm doing a well-paid job. But actually the obsession with home ownership perhaps did go a little bit far in that, to my mind, whether you're renting your home or you own your own home, it is still your home. And actually for some people, owning their own home might not be an attainable goal, but that shouldn't be socially unacceptable. That should be absolutely fine. And as long as we are, and if we are, making every home a safe home that is fit to live in, I think that becomes less of a problem. I think part of the difficulty we've had is that housing standards have got so poor and expectations are so low, and you can pay a fortune for very poor housing, particularly in London, but in metropolitan areas, but that balance shifts if you're paying a lot and getting so little. And I think if actually the quality of housing in this country improved drastically, home ownership, whilst a goal that should be attainable, might not be, it might not feel as big a problem, is I guess what I'm saying.
I think that was an amazing answer. Like, you brought in so many perspectives that I didn't even think about when I was writing these questions. If you could meet your undergraduate self and give her one piece of advice that you've learned the importance of over the years, what would it be?
I think it would be work out who you are and then be that person.
Thank you so much, Brooke.
It's been lovely to see you again.
Thanks for tuning in today to this episode of On the Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. Further information can be found in the description of this episode. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at LSESU Law Soc and LinkedIn at LSE's On the Case.